Hi, everybody. We managed to be on the air. Lately, I'm starting to wonder if really there is something to think about. Something wanting to silence my voice, but that ain't going to happen. So here I am. You're talking with Patricia Corey. Actually, you're not. You're listening to Patricia Corey. The show is Beyond the Matrix for people who think outside the box of convention. And as usual, I try to bring you some of the leading voices that are doing just that. I'm going to keep the introduction short because we lost a few minutes, but I do want you to know that I'm honored and thrilled to bring you Andrew Collins. He is a science and history writer, and the man has been around. He's the author of various books that challenge the way we perceive the past, and you probably know these as The Ashes of Angels, which came out about five years ago. Which shows that the watchers of the Book of Enoch were shamans responsible for the Neolithic Revolution. Whoo! And I'm particularly interested in his book that's just come out, which, by the way, I managed to get, Beneath the Pyramids. You all know that I'm fascinated and very involved with Egypt, and I'm going to find out what he knows about interesting things, chambers and caves, that I have yet to get into, but I pretty much have a feeling that down in the Osiris shaft that I did get into, there's a connection. So I apologize to you, Andrew. I know that I kind of messed up on the time, and I thank you for your flexibility.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me on your show. So I'm raring to go, raring to tell you all about Giza and its caves and the Hall of Records and all the conspiracy that has been generated recently there.
Yeah, there sure has, and we're going to get to that because I had Richard Gabriel on my show, and woo, it was kind of, you know, out there stuff. So, first of all, I want you to all know that the name of the book that we're talking about today is Beneath the Pyramids, Egypt's Greatest Secret Uncovered, Andrew Collins, and his website is andrewcollins.com. You'll want to go there after we finish so that you don't miss a word of what Andrew has to say. All right. That was fast. I know, I just want to tell everybody, by the way, I'm in Glastonbury. We're about to start our crop circle, too. I know Andrew's here as well. Lots of people here. New crop circle down today. I'm going to try to convince Andrew to have a beer with me somewhere along the line. All right, Andrew, here we go. Let's talk about your discovery of the cave complex in Egypt. Tell us.
All right. Well, I think probably most of your listeners already know the story to some degree, but on March the 3rd, 2008, myself, my colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson, and my wife Sue entered inside a previously unknown cave underworld on the plateau at Giza, just a few hundred yards to the west of the Great Pyramid. Now, I know this sounds absolutely fantastic, and indeed it was. It was like something out of an Indiana Jones film. But we managed to locate, after years of research work, I think this is important to stress, where we actually uncovered previously unknown documents that were nearly 200 years old that talked about a British diplomat called Henry Salt entering catacombs at Giza and travelling along them for a distance of several hundred yards before coming upon this large chamber that linked with three others of equal size. We interpreted that. We worked out exactly whereabouts Henry Salt had been on the plateau, and it just coincided with an area that we were already interested in, a particular tomb that nothing had ever been written or published about, which we referred to as the Tomb of the Birds. And we called it this simply because the only accounts of anything having occurred there come from the middle of the 19th century, where the British Egyptologist and explorer Richard Howard Vyse, along with the engineer John Shea Perrin, managed to uncover evidence of some kind of cult of the birds here. They found evidence of bird mummies being left as offerings within the tomb, and these were written up and mentioned within their work, only extremely briefly, and this led to us referring to the place as the Tomb of the Birds, because at this point, nothing had been published on this site, and, you know, so we just happened to call it that. Well, anyway, myself and my wife had been to this this tomb in January 2007. We'd explored it. We knew that it may be linked with some kind of underground complex, but we couldn't find anything then. This is a remote area, I must point out, where tourists don't go, and Egyptologists have never really taken an interest in what's going on here. I mean, it's somewhere that's remote, rarely visited by anybody. Anyway, we went back there in March 2008, this time hoping that we would find some evidence of an entrance into caves. And sure enough, just as we were about to leave, we found a crack in the rock that led into this massive natural cave dome, which itself was merely the entrance chamber to a whole series of natural caves that go into the bedrock. We travelled for a distance of around 100 metres. But, as mentioned earlier, Henry Salt and his colleague went for a distance of maybe 700 yards, and they never came to the end of the caves then. And we know that they basically go off in the direction of the second pyramid, which is almost certainly where they lead beneath, which is interesting because that's the legendary site of the Tomb of Hermes, according to Arab tradition. So this is really interesting in its own right.
But my question is, how can you say it's a remote area if it's within the walled confines, I would imagine, of Giza Plateau?
Well, the Giza Plateau is actually quite extensive. It's about 3 or 4 miles across in each direction.
So is this outside the wall that they've built?
I'm sorry?
Is this outside the wall that they've built?
No, it's within the walls themselves. But the thing is that the walls extend out into the desert and don't particularly mark anything specific. I mean, they've just been created. They don't house anything in particular other than the obvious monuments. But, you know, the walls or the fence, as it actually becomes in the far reaches of the desert itself, as I say, it's just been created. Exactly what was within it is catalogued to a degree. But what I can say is that the tomb we entered does not even appear within the standard reference books that give an account, a listing of, you know, all the tombs that are found on the plateau and what investigations have actually been done. And even since the publication of my book, Beneath the Pyramids, we've had Egyptologists all over the world looking for any information. The only thing that's been found is one rough plan that was done in either 1939 or 1940 of the tomb by the team belonging to George A. Reisner, the American Egyptologist. He sent some people in to the tomb, and they roughly sketched it during this period and actually designated it NC2, North Cliff 2, which they noted down within the notes that Reisner did. But these were never, ever published. So, you know, when we investigated the place, nothing in the world was published on this. I mean, the only account, as I mentioned, was from Howard Weiss and John Perring from 150 years ago. And, of course, obviously up to that point, there was nothing linking Henry Salt and his exploration of catacombs on Giza with this particular account. It was only the work that my colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson and I did that really tied the two together, and we realised that we were on to the correct place. So, you know, we were entering somewhere here that, to the best of our knowledge, nobody had explored in modern times. And I think I can safely say this now because Beneath the Pyramids came out last October. And since that time, no one has come forward to say that they actually discovered these caves beforehand. Not one person anywhere in the world within the Egyptological community or the New Age community or even local people. The only one person that we know that knew about them was a local tomb guardian who we encountered on that far reaches of the plateau. And he couldn't speak English, rarely came into contact with any tourists. He said he knew about the caves. He said they stretched for miles. But he said that he would never go into them himself because they were haunted by a giant snake called El Hanash. And I later found out that El Hanash is this sort of mythological creature that's supposed to live beneath the plateau and guard this this crystal or diamond, if anybody, it says, tries to approach it, it will blind them. However, one day somebody will come along that it will blind just in one eye, and this person will then go on to encounter this, you know, this diamond or crystal, and they will gain the knowledge and the power that it holds. This is an old ancient legend that I discovered that's never ever been published. In fact, none of this information about this giant serpent was known about at all in Giza. Now it's obviously something that's being talked about a lot within the New Age community. But before this time, there was absolutely nothing. So all of this is brand new information that was brought, you know, to the table for the first time in Beneath the Pyramids and the research that we did.
But, I mean, this is pretty exciting because I'm not going to say if it's true because there's no reason to doubt you, but this puts you on the map as truly a history maker, if nothing else.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it's too exciting for words.
Well, it is, and I mean, I think what people need to realise is that these caves, you know, are not illuminated by lanterns or things like this. I mean, you know, they are pitch dark. They are so dangerous that it is very difficult to even tread within them. They're full of bats. They're full of poisonous spiders. They're full of pits and voids in the ground, which you can easily fall through and break a leg or worse.
It sounds like you're describing the Duat.
Well, it is the Duat. I mean, you know, I'm pretty certain that these caves, which are natural, which would have been beneath the plateau for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, almost certainly influenced the development of the ancient Egyptian belief in the cave underworld known as the Duat. This was seen to be the netherworld that the pharaoh, or indeed the deceased in general, was meant to travel through and encounter, snakes and demons and go through various trials and tribulations, eventually coming out through another exit and rising up in the sky as the newly born sun, where he would be risen into the firmament, into the heavens to become at one with the stars. This is the tradition that's given in various ancient Egyptian texts, and they talk about this Duat underworld, and it is quite clearly, certainly in a physical representation, some kind of cave complex, and it's almost seen here and there to be that you are going through the gullet and the body and the bowels of a serpent to actually to encounter and experience this before exiting the other side. It was also, of course, seen as the place where the sun disappeared to at night. The sun was seen to set on the western horizon, travel through the Duat at night and rise again as it exited in the east to rise up into the sky, and continue its journey there. I mean, there are various different formulas within these these myths and legends, but all of them do generally relate to some kind of physical counterpart of the Duat, which has to be seen in terms of caves. And when we think that, obviously, we've got the Great Pyramid here, one of the wonders of the world, that, in my opinion, was constructed originally as a tomb for the pharaoh Khufu around 4,500 years ago. Plus, around this, you have another two Great Pyramids, one built for the pharaoh Khafre, another for the pharaoh Menkaure, all of the same family. And you've got to begin to ask yourself, is there some relationship between the fact that the Great Pyramid and its neighbours are located at Giza and the presence beneath these very monuments of this huge cave underworld? And I believe that the answer is yes. I mean, the American Egyptologist Mark Lerner came to the conclusion in his book, The Complete Pyramids, that the different corridors and chambers inside the Great Pyramid were not leading you for some kind of ascension by going upwards, but by going downwards, down into the earth, down into, through the bedrock itself, into some kind of cave complex that would allow the spirit to eventually journey and be released to become a spirit in the firmament at one with the stars. So in other words, you have to go down first before you rise upwards.
Yeah, that's a very interesting theory. I'm not necessarily in agreement with you that it was originally designed to be a tomb, but that will be the next time you come on. We'll go into detail on that.
When I say a tomb, I mean, obviously, you know, we're not talking here about a tomb that you might get in a churchyard. We're talking about a place of transformation, a place that's the womb of creation, somewhere that the soul can become the same as it was at the point of the creation of the universe. You know, this is not just a tomb. This is a place of complete transformation of the soul, you know, somewhere that would have been created on the most incredible geometry and oneness with the heavens, you know, and, of course, the earth itself. In other words, to plainly see it and to refer to it in terms of a tomb would actually be quite wrong in our modern terminology.
Good. I'm glad you say that because, in fact, for us, the tomb is the end and certainly the Egyptians weren't about ending in that passage.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. But tell me, I mean, this is so fascinating to me because I'm a frequent explorer in Egypt, too, and I didn't know about these caves. And I'm very curious to ask you on a personal level, what did it feel like? I don't know if you're an intuitive, but I imagine you are. And what did it evoke in you to be in there, besides wonder, of course?
I mean, it's difficult because we were in there on four occasions. The circumstance that we were there, I mean, although we were not breaking any rules or anything like that, there was a certain amount of local consternation over, the fact that we were inside the tombs and, we fully expected at some point to be thrown out, certainly on at least a couple of occasions, meant that it was difficult to really enjoy and be a part of what was going on down there. But having said that, it's not until we actually returned back to the UK that we started to realize their impact upon us, because constantly we started having dreams, about being back in the caves, about the bats. I remember I had dreams about a huge great serpent, a snake inside the caves, which was like sort of trying to communicate with me, speak to me. I mean, it was very, very odd. It was obvious that we'd made some connection, and more than that, that it was drawing us back. The caves were drawing us back again and again. On the first time we went there, which was in March 2008, we got in there twice. And we almost immediately made the decision to go back there the following month, April 2008, when we went in there another two times. So, as I say, in all, we went in there four times. And each time we were able to map further and further. We were able to take more and more photographs, get more and more film footage, and penetrate them deeper. And at the end of them, we found like this tube that condenses down to something that a person can only just squeeze through. And in all honesty, we made the decision not to go any further at this time because we simply did not have the correct equipment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't help but notice the resemblance to the symbolism that people experience when they do ayahuasca journeying, connecting through the serpent to the spirit world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, obviously that the ayahuasca experience is something that's common to South America, but we're still talking about the inner journeys of the mind. And, you know, I see the caves as symbolic of the womb, the birth tube of some kind of primeval goddess who would have been associated not just with the earth, but with the stars as well. She was remembered under the name of Nuit, the sky goddess, I believe, who was a personification of the Milky Way, both in the sky and as it goes beneath the earth as well. I believe that the other name that she was that this goddess was known by most commonly is Hathor, who was the mother, of course, of Horus the Elder. She was said to give birth to Horus in the form of a newborn calf each morning, which itself carried the sun into the sky. Now, Hathor and indeed Nuit both have these serpent symbolism and aspects to them, and both of them seem to be related, you know, to the earth as much as they are to the sky. So to me, you know, the caves, which, by the way, have red ochre upon the walls, somehow symbolize this journey through the body of the goddess, you know, to be reborn again symbolically at the time of dawn. This is what I feel very strongly. You know, you are inside the womb of the mother here, and I definitely believe this is what the people that used these caves possibly believed even before the time of the pharaohs. I think to truly comprehend what we have here, you have to look beyond the boundaries of Egypt, beyond the confines of dynastic Egypt, to Central Africa, and to the tribal African cultures, in particular people like the Dogon of Mali, to start fully appreciating what we have here.
Yes, well, I have brought forward a lot of the information about the Kemet, and I've had Stephen Mailer on talking about Kemetian wisdom, so the people that are listening are familiar with that. But yeah, I think that we are at the verge of being able to seriously identify and dispel the datelines that we currently have for Egypt.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, I'm happy myself, you know, through many, many years of research and work to accept the chronology of ancient Egypt. I have no problem with that at all. I think that there is a good case to suggest that the Sphinx might be older than current thinking tells us. Exactly how old is a matter of speculation. But I think that quite clearly there was activity on the plateau long before the pyramids were erected, and that this probably goes back to the time of the last ice age, probably 10 to 11,000 BC. I believe this because the ancient creation texts, in particular those that are still preserved to this day on the walls of the temple of Edfu in southern Egypt, talk about this primeval island on a lake, possibly fed by the waters of the Nile. And it talks about it being north of the city of Memphis. And Memphis, of course, was the old capital of Egypt, which is located just to the south of Giza. And it's quite clear that this primeval mound of creation that was seen in terms of like an egg, you know, like the first thing created in the universe to rise out the primeval waters, was somewhere in the region of Giza. And the Edfu building texts also tell us that there was some kind of entrance known as the Place of the Well that led down into an underground complex known as the Duat Embar, the underworld of the soul, and that within this place, divine beings called Shebtu, or the eldest ones, would descend to carry out acts of creation in the outside world using power objects. Plus, it was said that within this structure was something known as the seed or the embryo, which was, again, a power object which I would liken to the Shiva Lingam of Hindu tradition, like these conical-shaped stones that were found within the underground vaults of temples in Asia and India that symbolized the point of first creation. I think that there was something like this at Giza within our cave underworld in the past, and that it's this that's remembered today as this crystal or diamond that remains to be found beneath the plateau. And of course, obviously, this type of idea plays right into the hands of people that believe that that what we have at Giza is the remnant of Atlantis.
That's going to be my question.
This is not something which I personally subscribe to at all. Having written a whole book called Gateway to Atlantis that looks at the origins of the Plato myth and the development of the Atlantis story, I would say that there is very, very little to connect Atlantis with Egypt, but much to connect it with the area of the Caribbeans and the Bahamas. But that's a different story for a different day. However, you know, there is a lot of people at the moment that believe that that the cave underworld at Giza will lead to some kind of Atlantean Hall of Records. I can't say that this is right or this is wrong, particularly as I'm a supporter of Ed Casey and his psychic readings, and have talked on many occasions to the Edgar Casey Foundation in Virginia Beach. Plus, I must make it clear that our research trips to Egypt, where we discovered the caves, were actually sponsored in part by the Edgar Casey Foundation, who recognised the importance of our work. However, I would argue with exactly what the so-called Hall of Records are. I don't see them in terms of some kind of you know, Atlantean style room with you know, stacked you know, books of stone. You know, to me, this is a modern interpretation of something that is maybe 10 to 15,000 years old.
Uh-huh. Well, what did you find in there? Did you have any, of course, I'm not suggesting that you found hieroglyphs, but did you have any signs of human activity, ancient presence in that area, in that complex?
What we have in here is a lot of simulacra, you know, natural stone that is formed into the shape of animal heads and things like this. Mm-hmm. One of which, very prominently, is a serpent head, which I think is really important, because we know that such simulacra has been venerated, you know, images like serpent heads in Egypt and in Africa in general for maybe as much as 70,000 years. In the Kalahari Desert, for instance, there is a rock shelter with a serpent head simulacra in there that's known to have been venerated by the local San Bushmen for this exactly that period of time, 70,000 years. in Egypt, there are at least two other rock simulacra in the shapes of serpent heads that were venerated. One of them is on the borders of Sudan. I can't remember the exact location at the moment, but it is marked by a temple of Hathor, again a link with this particular goddess. And there is actually a stack of rock which has a serpent head at the top of it, which, as I said, is seen in terms of a serpent. It's actually shown in hieroglyphic imagery and murals and frescoes at this actual location within the temple.
In the cave?
I'm sorry?
It's not actually in a cave,
no, but there is a grotto that is sacred to Hathor that is right by the side of it. I've forgotten the exact location at the moment. It's gone out of my head, but that's there. Plus, also what we've uncovered inside the caves is that there is a lot of red ochre on the walls. Now, this seems to be natural. This is obviously iron oxide. It seems to ooze out as powder. This would have been seen as sacred. Red ochre was used as a symbol of death and rebirth right since the Paleolithic times. There are no hieroglyphs down there, not one that we uncovered. There is evidence of mummies or fragments of mummies that almost certainly were part of some kind of animal or bird deposits. This is in the early part of the caves. But to actually find the true archaeology, you're going to have to start digging through the floors. You know, just like going into any other natural cave, the chances are that you're not going to see anything on the surface. But it is possible that there is evidence of crude rock art on the walls. That does seem to be possible. Now, I mean, unfortunately, because it is so old, it is something which is barely distinguishable from, you know, the actual stains upon the walls themselves. But I don't discount this as a possibility of being there.
How exciting. How exciting for you to have made this discovery.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I think your listeners need to know is that I've heard strong rumours that a television series that started airing this week on the History Channel in the USA called Chasing Mummies, featuring the exploits of Dr. Zoe Hawass, will actually feature the Giza Cave Complex. Now, Zoe Hawass has denied their existence publicly on his website within a blog. He basically said that I went into the caves, into the tomb, and simply got lost within the tomb and thought that it was larger than what it actually was, which of course is very silly, because we know full well what we found, and we have hundreds of photographs to prove that. You know, plus we know that of at least one other person that's been into those caves since that time. Well, now obviously more, because obviously if a TV film crew has been down there, an awful lot more people have actually experienced the caves themselves.
However, Zoe wanted to claim it for his own discovery, of course.
He will claim it. Well, I mean, that was always going to be the way. There is no way that an amateur like myself, and what am I? I am I'm a writer, I'm a journalist, and a historical researcher. There is no way that somebody like myself can make such a big discovery so close to the Great Pyramid. I think this is important to point out. This is just a few hundred yards or meters to the west of the Great Pyramid. This is a huge embarrassment to the Egyptian authorities. Massively. There is absolutely no way that they could recognize this discovery from an Englishman, an amateur, you know, who writes about it in his book.
Who wasn't even on an archaeological dig.
I'm sorry?
an Englishman who is not an archaeologist and who wasn't on a sanctioned
dig. Absolutely. You've got it. Yeah.
Okay,
so it's just not going to happen. But I must point out that
do you have the intention to go through them and find the way out the other side, and in so doing, enact the journey through the Duat?
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, you talked earlier on about the Osiris shaft. I mean, so far, that doesn't connect with the cave system, but the Giza Plateau is like Swiss cheese. It's full
that's
of
right.
holes. And I believe that the cave system that we entered eventually goes right beneath the main pyramid field and links up with other caves that take you right into the area of the Sphinx. And who knows what we might find there. Maybe, just maybe, this is where the Hall of Records is actually to be found, which I think probably brings us on now to the recent stories that some kind of secret excavations have been taking place in the area of the Sphinx. I'm sure many of your listeners will have heard all about this.
Let me interject that I had Richard Gabriel and Bill Brown on my show, and they were making some pretty intense claims about their discovery of the Atlantean technology. Big statements
about
that.
Will you tell me what they claimed, and I'll tell you whether it's true or not?
Well, they claimed that they knew where these points were, where there were buried Atlantean, I'm not sure if they said it was crystal technology or what, but that they knew without question where these places were, and that one of their colleagues was running for his life because he had filmed it. So I challenged him on that.
Can I stop you there?
Sure.
Can I go back one? Right. Mm-hmm. One of their colleagues had filmed it. Right, what this is referring to is a piece of phone footage that roughly goes for 10 minutes long and shows total darkness.
That's
claims
right.
to show secret excavation work on the plateau in the middle of the night. I'm correct, aren't I?
Yes, and I was about
okay.
to tell you that I challenged him on that because I said the quality of what you're showing us and the sound are absolutely, completely inconsistent. And he said, well, we have more information. We're going to air this to the public.
Well, okay. Well, to start off with, that piece of footage showed nothing but
he
darkness.
He never did that.
Plus, the sounds on it are false. What you actually hear is a loop of sounds that goes round and round and round. That has been added afterwards.
So, what do you think that Richard Gabriel's intention is? Do you think he's working for people that want to silence you, or do you think that he's a...
No. I mean, basically, Bill Brown and Richard Gabriel, who I am in touch with, believe that it is their destiny to find Atlantean artifacts within a Hall of Records-like complex beneath the Giza Plateau. And good luck to them. But the thing is that it's important to remember that, you know, just because you have a belief doesn't necessarily mean that it is a reality. I mean, I have personal beliefs relating to the plateau. You know, I also believe that there may be hidden chambers to be discovered beneath the plateau, maybe even some kind of crystal that represents the point of first creation. I believe that this could be the remnant of some kind of high culture that goes back, you know, maybe 11 or 12,000 years, arguably even older than that. But these are my personal beliefs. I cannot prove them, you know, and I have to detach these beliefs from the reality of what is going on the plateau. And the reality is that we have found a cave complex. It does exist. However, as yet, there are no Hall of Records. You know, there are going to be chambers discovered, surely, somewhere along the line within these caves. Perhaps they have broken through into existing tombs and they've been created into chambers. And just maybe this relates to a much older age, but these are hopes. This
right.
is something of the heart. And I think that it should not be confused with reality. And the problem that Bill Brown and Richard Gabriel have is that they are confusing fantasy with reality.
Well, let's call it they're confusing fantasy with objective scientific observation. Because reality is something that we really can't define anymore.
Well, I mean, we can all have fantasies. We can all have dreams, imaginations, whatever. This is good. I think it is important that we do. Otherwise, the world would be far too dry without any imagination. But, you know, we have to put things into two specific areas of the brain. You know, one is the hard fact, intellectual side, and the other is the intuitive, creative, artistic side. And they are mutually compatible, but you have to see them as in separate compartments. You know, when you come to dealing with the reality of the world
around
you. Something
that's interesting, though, is that you talk about the fact that...
Hello?
Are you with me?
I'm with
Good.
You, yeah.
I just wanted to say that Richard Gabriel went into the caves as well. Is that correct?
He did, yeah. What happened was that Richard came along to one of my lectures that showed all of the slides, beautiful slides that we took of the caves. This was in September 2009. So what he decided to do was to go out to Egypt and try and get in the caves himself, which is what he achieved 2 months later in November 2009. And, you know, his interpretation of what he sees in the caves, I don't necessarily agree with. But, I mean, you know, we can all, you know, we're all quite open to our interpretation of what's going on. But, I mean, it is important to point out I'm sorry?
He claims to have seen inside the cave.
Yeah, he was inside the caves. Oh, yes, absolutely. He went inside the caves. He went inside the caves in November 2009.
Up in communication, because everything you're saying is so utterly exciting and fascinating, and I wanted to be able to say goodbye to you in person without just having it lead off into the Twilight Zone. So I would like to tell all of you that you have been listening to a true pioneer, and certainly a man who's contributed so much to discovering the mysteries of our incredible experience on this planet. His name, of course, you know him, Andrew Collins. This amazing book, by the way, I've got it here. The photos of the caves are awesome. I hope you're going to be putting more of these pictures out, because it's just completely exciting. Andrew's website is, of course, andrewcollins.com. Check out this man. If you don't know who I'm talking about, which is probably improbable, you're in for some very exciting information. Andrew, you're going to be speaking at the Glastonbury Symposium. You're the headline speaker the last night.
Absolutely. Yeah, next weekend.
Yeah, and I'm the closing speaker. So I'm closing the last speaker of the day at 4 p.m. on July 25th at the Glastonbury Symposium in Glastonbury. And
right.
Andrew is here, will be the guest speaker at night. So do you think we can sneak in a little bit of a beer party?
I'm sure we can. Absolutely.
I've got to meet you. I really respect your work. And, you know, it's too synchronistic to miss the opportunity.
Excellent.
Andrew, have you got a parting word for our captive audience?
Not really, no. I mean, if people want to keep up with this, go on to andrewcollins.com, you know, read what's on there, but also follow the story on Facebook as well, on my profile page there, which you can link to via andrewcollins.com anyway, because, you know, anything that happens, I'll tell you about immediately it happens. So stay up to date with this.
Okay, yeah, and all of you know how I feel about the Egyptian authorities and how difficult they're making it for us to continue our work of exploration. So really a big, big deal. And I thank you, Andrew, for your brilliant work.
All right, everybody. This is Patricia.
I'm here in England. We've just had a new crop circle come down. I will keep you posted about that. You can also check my page on Facebook. And, of course, my site, theory.net. I don't know where I'll be next week, but I will be with you, bringing you more of cutting-edge information that keeps you out of the box of convention and soaring in the free thought zone. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Andrew. Have you with Andrew and get firsthand insights, even more insights, into one of might be the most important stories that's breaking in our lifetimes. Okay, well, and don't forget, keep sending positive thoughts to the Gulf. Keep writing to the presidents of your countries acceptable that they allow this poisoning of our ocean to continue. For the whales and the dolphins and all the sea bee, for humanity, for the planet, please get out of your lazy zone and take action. And with that, I leave you all an incredible day and more searching for truth.